Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Fonterra 2021 Interim Results Investor Briefing. I'll now hand the conference over to your first speaker for today, Miles Hurrell, CEO. Thank you, and please go ahead.
Kia ora, and thank you for joining us. I'm Miles Hurrell, CEO, and joined here by Mark Rivers, CFO. I'm going to take you through the overview of our results and some of the progress we're making across a number of our regions. Mark will then take us through more detailed analysis of the numbers before handing back to me, and we'll take you through what we can expect for the second half of the year. Before I get into things, I want to highlight this will be our first interim results of reporting under our new customer-led operating model. You'll see more emphasis on the three regions in today's presentations. Those regions, of course, are Asia-Pacific, Greater China, and the rest of the world we refer to as EMENA. Within each of the regions, you'll still see our three channels of ingredients, food service, and consumer. Let's get into it. The team have delivered a positive set of results for the first six months of F21. Sitting here in New Zealand, we've been relatively sheltered by the full impact of COVID-19. For many of our people on the ground in our markets around the world, it's been a very different story. The pandemic has been rife, and some of our people and customers have found themselves in lockdown some 12 months on. This hasn't been easy. We're proud of how our people have responded to the situation. They've supported each other, focused on what's in their control, and worked together to create demand for our New Zealand milk and manage our supply chain challenges so customers can rely on us to get products to market. You'll see this in the results in our headline numbers. Firstly, we have a 7.30-7.90 dollar milk price range. Our reported profit after tax is 391 million dollars. We're very pleased with this number. While it's down on the headline number versus F20 last year, of course, we reported the gain on sale from both DFE and Foodspring divestments. Our net profit after tax is 418 million dollars, which is up 43%, and we're paying an interim dividend. All of this shows that our strategy, which we refreshed in F19, is now up and running, but most importantly, starting to deliver results. Our strategy has ensured that our teams are all heading in the right direction. In COVID world, where there's a lot of uncertainty, this has been really important. It's all about chasing value and not volume. It means we're prioritizing New Zealand milk and growing demand for it by really understanding our customers and differentiating our co-op's milk through innovation, sustainability, and efficiency. We're not a one-trick pony, and you can see how we go to market. We're playing across five categories: core and dairy, food service, pediatrics, sports and active, and medical and healthy aging. This kind of diversification has been a real strength through COVID, and it's allowed us to move milk into the products and markets where the demand has been the highest, and we've made the most of it. Let's now take a look at what the strategy has looked like in each of our regions. Starting with APAC, our EBIT here is up 9%, with the vast majority coming from consumer. We saw more people cooking at home and, more importantly, cooking with dairy. Our New Zealand consumer business has put a substantial emphasis on sustainability this half, gaining zero carbon certification for Anchor Enriched Milks and launching a plant-based bottle for a 2-liter Anchor Blue Milk here in New Zealand. It's been great seeing the co-op getting behind food banks and helping get our products to those that need it most. One of the challenges, though, for us in APAC has been our Australian ingredients business, which has been impacted by challenging trading conditions, including the China trade relations, contraction of the Daigou channel, and some shipping delays. Greater China has been our standout performer. EBIT is up 38%. Almost two-thirds of Greater China's 339 million dollar EBIT came from our food service business, which increased EBIT by 64%, a phenomenal result. This has been achieved on a similar metric tons, but have moved more milk into higher value products such as our UHT cream. We've launched new products like our first ambient cream and developed 80 new ways of taking these products to market over the last six months. This has also helped increase utilization of our Darfield cream cheese plant and also our Clandeboye mozzarella factory. The team have increased demand through entering more cities and innovation, and now we're in over 370 cities across China. New news today is for China that we've agreed with a joint venture partner to undertake a sales process for our JV farms in China. Reason for this divestment is the same as why we want to sell our own China farms. It's about allowing us to focus even more on our New Zealand milk. It's clear China is one of the most important strategic markets. We're committed to growing the value of our China business, which we'll do by bringing the goodness of New Zealand milk to Chinese consumers. Our third region is EMENA. It's Africa, Middle East, Europe, North Asia, and the Americas. been a bit tougher here, unfortunately, as you can see this reflected in the reduction in EBIT. The main reason it's down is because of reduced sales volumes and lower margins in ingredients. We've shifted milk from AMENA to higher returning markets. And while this may not be so positive for AMENA, if you take a co-op-wide lens, it's a good thing to have made the most of our ability to move milk around to higher returning markets and products. On a positive note for AMENA, we've seen a really strong performance from Chile, and across all markets within the AMENA have reduced their costs. It was great to see new sports and active products launching. That's the NZMP Milk Phospholipid 70, which is our first product designed for mental wellness, such as stress, mood enhancement, and cognitive performance. Behind these three regions is a big engine room for the cooperative. Without it, we wouldn't have products to sell in the regions. It includes activities like milk collection, manufacturing, and innovation and R&D. It's also where the decisions get made about how best to connect with customers and assets, farmers, and markets to turn the milk we collect into the most valuable products. It's a big part of our business, employing over 10,000 people, and there are plenty of highlights for the first 6 months. We've already talked about the optimisation of our milk and how we've moved into products and markets with the highest value. We've also talked about how we're dealing with supply chain challenges. You can see here that 71% of our product deliveries have been made in full on time, plus or minus 1 week. Prior to COVID, this number averaged about 90%. However, despite this reduction, our performance is considered reliable relative to the market. The recent rollout of the milk vat monitoring systems that has been installed on farms has improved the quality of our milk supplied to our factories and created opportunities to optimise our tanker pickup schedules, with the success of the implementation so far allowing us to budget for the removal of 5 tankers for next season. I'll now hand over to Mark to take us through the numbers in a bit more detail.
Great. Thank you, Miles. So looking at our total group performance, which is inclusive of our discontinued operations, our milk collections are slightly down on last year. We've had strong demand, and the sales book is well contracted. As you can see, the impact of the well-documented global supply chain challenges, with sales volume down 41,000 metric tons, or 2%. But sales book is well contracted, and we expect to have caught up on those delays by the end of the financial year. Revenue is down, so in part due to the delayed shipments, but it's predominantly down as a result of lower average prices compared to the prior period. Our total group gross profit increased $54 million due to our gross margin increasing from 16% to 17.4%. Operating expenses are down $37 million as a result of the businesses focusing on what's in their control, like targeted selling and promotional spend during lockdown periods. I will note that we expect to increase our A&P spend in the second half. Improved gross margin and the focus on managing costs has resulted in our normalized EBIT increasing 17%, up $100 million to $684 million. Our net financing costs are $32 million lower due to lower average debt and a reduction in global interest rates. These strong first half earnings equate to normalized earnings per share of 25 cents after deducting non-controlling interests. Next slide. Our net debt is down $0.2 billion to $5.6 billion. Please note the seasonal profile, of course, of our working capital requirements. It typically means that our debt level is higher in the first half compared to the full year as the working capital needs are reduced. Our target is to have our year-end gearing come in below 40%, and we are continuing to stay focused, of course, on working capital management as well as receivables and payables. And we began the first half of the year with higher levels of inventory carried over from previous year, which combined with lower sales revenue has resulted in higher inventory days. And as a result of the higher inventory days, our working capital days are higher. The business remains focused on the timely collection of receivables, and the receivables days are consistent with last year, and overdue receivables are actually down. Payable days are also similar levels to last year. Next slide. This slide shows the matrix of our business by markets and channels and just highlights really the diversity across them. Our three regions have similar revenues, but as you can see, we do have a higher EBIT margin in Greater China. It also shows the region's earnings are dominated by different channels. So Greater China, you see the importance of food service. Asia Pacific, you see the importance of the consumer business. And in AMENA, the ingredients businesses. It is a similar situation for the channels, except the ingredients channel, which AMENA contributes the most earnings to, but Greater China is also a strong contributor. So these next two slides show the margins by region and then by channel. Greater China's gross margin has increased from 14.3% to 17.7%. We continue to shift milk into high-value products, having released three new cream products. One of those is the Anchor Easy Topping Cream. It's the first ambient cream, which enables us to enter into new cities which do not have extensive cool supply chains. Greater China operating expenses have increased $13 million as we continue to develop demand. However, in the context of $94 million or 38% increase in our Greater China EBIT, it's money well spent. Asia Pacific increased earnings $16 million to $190 million. The majority of our consumer markets and brands within Asia Pacific benefited from the COVID-19 stay-at-home culinary trend, including our Australia consumer brands like Western Star, which aided in extending our market leadership position in chilled spreads, where our value share increased from 33.1% up to 35.7%, and in volume from 25.4% to 27.7%. Now, while our gross profit declined $61 million in EMENA, we did divert milk to other channels and regions, which preserved the EMENA margin overall, which was up slightly at 14.7%. All three channels in EMENA reduced operating expenses, which helped to partially offset the lower gross profit, with EMENA EBIT down only $15 million. So next slide. Once again, you can see the strength of the Greater China food service business, with the food service gross margin increasing from 18.6% to 26.1%. All three regions had improved earnings in their food service businesses. Food service EBIT increased $115 million, or 80%, to $258 million. And the final point I just make on food service is that despite allocating more milk into our food service channel, we actually sold fewer metric tons, and that's just due to product mix. So as the products we allocated more milk to, such as UHT cream, use more milk solids than, say, UHT milk. The consumer channel, mentioned earlier, benefited from the COVID-19 stay-at-home culinary trend. However, we've also had success with new product development. In Chile, we launched a new yogurt and dessert product, and both products won Product of the Year as voted by Chilean consumers in their respective yogurt and desserts categories. This success has helped us grow our value and volume share in the Chilean consumer channel, where value share is up 0.6% to 30.2%, and volume share is up 0.5% to 31.3%. So it's another good success story. And back to you, Miles, to discuss the outlook.
Great. Thanks, Mark. Now, our results today show that demand for dairy is resilient in a COVID world. While we've had a strong first half, we are expecting our earnings to come under significant pressure in the second half, and the simple reason for this is our increased input costs as a result of the higher farm gate milk price. Our strong farm gate milk price is good news for the co-op's farmers and New Zealand. With a midpoint of $7.60 per kilogram of milk solids, it would see us contribute over $11.5 billion into the New Zealand economy. But it does put a lot of pressure on our margins, and this will be seen in our earnings performance in the second half. Our teams understand the challenges that will come with the high farm gate milk price, and we're already seeing the extra effort we're putting in to drive sales. We're staying on strategy, focusing on what's in their control and driving demand for our New Zealand milk. There's still more work to do, but our improved performance and reduced debt levels are helping us build the financial strength of the co-op. I'll now hand back and ask for questions. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin that Q&A process. Once again, if you wish to ask a question, just please press star 1 on your telephone keypad and then just wait for your name to be announced. Also, if at any time you need to cancel your request, it's just by pressing the pound or the hash key. But our first question today comes from Arie Dekker from Jarden. Please ask your question, Arie.
Oh, yeah, good afternoon. This one's just regarding the strategy and some commentary, recent commentary. So in the CEO chairman letter in the interim, there's a comment regarding a commitment to divesting non-core businesses to reduce debt and focus on creating value. And in the recent letter that you sent to shareholders around the capital structure survey, you suggested you were completing your portfolio review work through the asset divestment processes previously announced. I guess I just asked for some clarity on sort of where you fit on, what you're targeting to get that debt down to, and whether we should still expect any more meaningful asset divestments in the future from those that have been announced today.
Hey, good afternoon, Arie. It's Mark here. Thanks for the question. So the we don't see anything beyond what we've announced already in terms of divestments in the portfolio. So completing China Farms, which the wholly owned China Farms, which we expect to complete in this financial year. And then we are still in discussions on Brazil. And we've announced that we've commenced a process now on the JV farms in China. But beyond those, we don't need more than that to get us into the debt to EBITDA range that we've targeted for ourselves, which is to get to the 2.5 to 3x in the next year or two. So we think that gives us sufficient, you know, balance sheet capacity in line with the strategy. So there's not more intended beyond that at this stage.
Okay, so in terms of the capital structure review work that you're looking to complete in the next few months, and with a view to, if you have to, going to the November AGM, that won't be informed by divestment of any other assets, you know, Australia or Brazil, Australia or Chile, for example.
That's correct. You know, I don't see that influencing that discussion at all, really.
Sure. And then just with regards to the Brazil sale process, I haven't seen it, I think, in what I've gone through. Just an update on sort of the process and timing there.
Yeah, so this one's taken a bit longer. I mean, it's been more hit by COVID in terms of being able to run a proper process with no visits and due diligence and all that sort of thing. But the business itself, actually, the underlying business has been performing pretty well. They've been improving on market shares, et cetera. And so we continue to be in discussion with interested parties. And it's just going to have to run its course. We're holding it, obviously, held for sale in the accounts, which means that you intend to be able to sell it in the next 12 months in principle with that. But obviously, we'll have to see each time as we go. The overarching approach with all that, of course, is to just make sure that we're getting maximal value. We're not just going to take any price.
Sure. And then just the last one, I mean. Look, fantastic progress on the new disclosure, which is, you know, very helpful. I just have a couple of questions just with regards a few things in there that I might have expected or just get a sense of whether you're going to go further. So, in Asia Pacific, you broke out Australia, but you didn't break out New Zealand. On the group attribution, I have to admit I'm still trying to keep my head around that completely. But in terms of, I guess, providing that attribution by product as well as region, is that something that we can expect to sort of see in the future? And then just finally, given your increased emphasis on capital allocation framework, that are you also looking to progress allocating your capital base across the regions as well?
Yeah. Look. Thanks for the comment on the. You know, we put a lot of work into being able to split it out this way. I think it does give a different visibility to the business to see it both. So you see the channel visibility, but then you see the regions, and obviously there's a bit of. Thinking that's gone into how do we allocate the coup and CPM and all of that. I'd like to see this settle for a while, and then we can see what other transparency would be helpful. The goal is just to make sure that you have good visibility over what the levers are in the business.
So we could expect to see some further information added in time, as early as the say.
Yeah. That's something I would always be looking at is what else is meaningful, based on the most important parts of the business. You know, we highlighted Australia this time because we're really treating it now as an integrated business. So you get the full picture of ingredients, consumer, and food service as one unit. And so that was the reason to kind of put a special spotlight on that one.
Sure. And final one, just on the CapEx for the full year, would you expect that to be a bit more second half weighted and sort of in line with your previous guidance?
Yeah, that's right. No, we're on track with CapEx, sort of $600 million for the full year. I think we're about $100 million year to date, $112 million, something like that. So it's quite back end, second half weighted. And part of the reason for that is just that you'll recall last season we couldn't get everything we needed to get done during the shutdown. And so some of that is deferred, but we have to wait until we're back in shutdown in order to get those done. But, we're tracking along on CapEx.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay, your next question comes from the line of Joshua Dale from Craigs Investment Partners. Please ask your question, Joshua.
Good afternoon. Just a few questions from me. First one, you delivered EPS of 25 cents in the first half. You maintain the lower end of full-year guidance at 25 cents, which implies you think there's a possibility you could deliver zero earnings in that second half. What's sort of keeping you so conservative at that lower end?
Josh, it's Miles here. I mean, clearly that quite a significant ramp-up in milk price over the last probably 3 or 4 months, but in particular 2 weeks ago, suggests that our margin is going to come under pressure in second half, including stream returns. So that's why we think it's important we keep an eye on that. But you're right, at 25 for the half and then the full year of 25 to 35, it does suggest some headwinds in that back end.
Dairy prices remain high and stream returns also remain under pressure, does that sort of imply we could see the same for the first half of next year?
A lot does depend on what happens with the underlying commodity prices. At these levels, I expect that'll continue to put some pressure on. But it's also giving some time to for the other products to catch up in terms of pricing and to find that balance. What's really thrown us is the profile of this sudden rise in pricing, which makes it hard to for the other parts of the portfolio to catch up. But as we enter the new season, you just keep in mind the seasonal profile of the milk. So I think we're in a little bit of a spot now where we're kind of between seasons. And so that's probably an aspect of it, a bit of supply disruption. But there is strong underlying demand, of course, underneath it all too, which is helpful. So yeah, a lot of moving parts still going on.
Thank you. Makes sense. And just at your FY19 result, you came out with EPS targets of 40 cents by FY22, 50 cents by FY24. I assume they're potentially a little ambitious if dairy prices and stream returns continue as they are. Can you sort of talk to whether you still have those targets and whether there are any changes in your thinking as to the delivery of those and what's going to drive that?
Right. No, we would still stick to those. Getting to that sort of 50 cent EPS level out in those years. Obviously, there's going to be fluctuation from year to year. This is an example of that, right? Where you see that. But we expect that to sort of balance out. And what's important is that underneath it all, that we continue to perform, do well on the food service business, on the consumer businesses, that those portfolios, perform. And that's what we're seeing really in most of those areas. Obviously, COVID has been another bit of an impact and a shock here, but we're seeing the benefits of that portfolio effect really come as we come through even those kinds of shocks. So yeah, no, we would stick. We want to stick to that aspiration.
Just on the consumer and food service divisions, when dairy prices lift, are elevated as they are now, do those costs flow through to those divisions immediately, or is there a bit of a lag? And what's the ability of those divisions to pass on the higher costs?
Yeah, so there is a bit of a lag on that. I mean, so one is we have internal transfer prices from ingredients into those units, so they're meant to model sort of arm's length approaches, and so there is a bit of a lag as those prices get set.
It's meant to model what happens in arm's length relationships as well. So the first impact you'll see is in that coup CPM area, where you'll see that kind of swing through the stream returns essentially.
Thanks. Is there any indication you can provide around how many days or weeks or months that lag is approximately?
Yeah, so Simon here. So on the ingredients products, it's basically adjusted fortnightly. And then for consumer and food service, it varies between monthly and quarterly.
Great. Thank you very much.
Once again, just a reminder, if you wish to ask a question, it's just by pressing star 1 on your telephone. But your next question comes from Chelsea Ledbetter from Forsyth Barr. Please ask your question, Chelsea.
Great. Hi, guys. And I guess, first of all, I want to reiterate Ari's comments around the disclosure. It's certainly very helpful and adds a bit more context on what's going on in various parts of the business. Maybe just expanding on, I appreciate you've given us quite a bit of commentary around Greater China in particular, but just taking that a little bit further, you've talked a lot about value versus volume and the change in mix, et cetera, that you've managed to achieve in that business. Just interested in your comments around, I guess, one, how much further opportunity is still remaining to continue to do that? And I guess, secondly, has there been any tailwinds from COVID that's helping you out there? We have heard a bit about stockpiling anecdotally in that market. So is there anything there that we need to think about that maybe isn't sustainable?
Yeah, hi Chelsea, Miles Hurrell here. So a couple of things. I think there's plenty of runway to go. If you start with food service, we talk about moving into another 20-odd cities across China in this last 6 months and a number of new product initiatives, product development opportunities. So I think there's a lot of runway to go. When you look at the capital investments we've made back here in New Zealand over the past sort of 5 years, there's still plenty of room in the tank to better utilise those. So I think from a food service perspective, it's fine. I don't hear any stockpiling from a food service or consumer perspective. I have picked up some rumours around stockpiling from an ingredients, but I don't see any evidence of that. I think we've seen underlying demand in China. They came out of COVID clearly faster than anyone else, and we're seeing that pick up with the underlying demand. So I think it's still a positive story in China.
Okay, no, I appreciate it. Clear. And then maybe coming to the supply chain commentary that you've made, appreciate you certainly don't seem to be facing the same challenges that others are in terms of how you manage the supply chain, but, it has had some impact. I guess I'm just interested, has it got worse since balance date, or, I guess, is that starting to ease yet for you, and how should we be thinking about, what that is doing in terms of inventory earnings, et cetera? Is that starting to ease in the second half, or is that something that we should still be thinking about as being factored into that guidance for the second half?
Yeah, so probably from balance date to today, it's probably been static, but starting to see a significant improvement from here on through. So we see no concerns, certainly at year end, and in fact, even by Q3, we'd like to think we're through and went on top of it. And there were some media articles yesterday which painted a pretty clear picture of repositioning empty containers into the South Island, which will go a heck of a long way to clearing the backlog that exists. So I'm feeling really confident about the supply chain. Again, while the numbers, we've seen a bit of a drop from where we were this time last year in terms of our performance, still really pleased with the performance of our supply chain against when you look at things on a global basis.
Okay, and just last question from me. In terms of the dividend, just interested in, I guess the way I'm thinking about payout at the moment is probably towards the lower end of your payout range that you've given us before, given you're still trying to, get the debt levels down, and I appreciate you've made quite a bit of progress. But is that the right way to think about it, or is there a different way, now that the balance sheet has come back into sort of levels that you wanted it to be?
Yeah, Chelsea, it's Mark. Look, part of the whole reset was to take a good look at the dividend policy, and as we talked at the year end last year, we've got a new policy set up so that 40-60% is sort of the targeted distribution range, and I think within that range, the board has full discretion just looking at the full context. Certainly, the more that we are in within the debt to EBITDA targets, then the more comfortable you are in playing within that range, and the further away you are from it, then the more that factors into things. But at this stage, we'll just have to see where we are at year end. I think meanwhile we just focus on delivering that performance, put the board in a position to be able to make its judgment based on the full year.
Okay, and I guess just extending that a bit further. Well, I've got you, Mark. Should we be thinking about your objective here being, steady dividend to / growing dividends as you work towards your EPS targets, or may this be a bit volatile depending on sort of how the EPS moves from year to year and milk prices and various other things?
Again, we'll always take the whole context, into consideration when we're looking at that. But the intention is to be able to distribute 40-60% of what we've earned on an ongoing basis. So take the 5-cent interim as a signal of confidence in the full year, in that we're able to so if we deliver on the 25-35 cents, then that puts us in a good position there. But so I think it also signals discipline on the balance sheet as well.
Okay. No, I appreciate the color. Thanks for your time.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay. There are no further questions at this time, so I'll hand the conference back to the presenters.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your time. And if you have any questions, please give us a call. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.